Crime Stoppers, howdy, howdy, ho. It's Daniel Markham here with Nerd Roundup at DanielBMarkham.com. Thanks for coming by. If you've never been to a Nerd Roundup before, there's nothing here that actually is worth a damn, but we're happy to have you anyway. This is basically a lot of technical folks talking about technical stories of the week and with an eye to how cool it is technically. We like to model the behavior we want to see in teams, and good teams are able to sit back and talk about dang near anything. So just belly up to the lunch counter, grab your sandwich or whatever your food of choice is, and sit down and we'll talk about some cool nerd stuff. This week I have James Greening with me. James. Good to see you.
Daniel, nice to see you too.
So let's just go right to it here. First thing is Eric Weinstein and this UFO, UAP thing. Have you heard of Eric Weinstein?
I hadn't, but I follow him now on Twitter.
Yeah. Eric's a super smart guy. Eric and his brother Brett, something about those Weinstein kids. Eric actually was the number one or number two guy with Peter Thiel, running venture capital. He's also a trained physicist, if I remember correctly. I think he has a degree in economics as well, or math. Super smart guy. Did some intellectual dark web stuff. Kind of backed off because he didn't want to get canceled. He's, as far as I know, extremely liberal. But anyway, the cool part of this story is Eric sort of represents most of us nerdy folks who have looked at this UFO story over the years and said, you know, it's just nothing. Swamp gas, it's weather balloons. I've been fascinated with the whole thing because of how people react to like seeing something they don't know what it is. That fascinates me much more than the fact that there are things we don't understand in the world. And so Eric is now going, you know, actually, maybe we are seeing some stuff we don't understand instead of it just being some trivial explanation. So have you been following this UFO thing?
I know it's been getting a lot more talking these days. You know, there's high-profile people, you know, in the Navy and such talking about it. And, you know, everybody's baffled. And
yeah. Yeah, I think, in my mind, and this is the biggest leap I'm willing to make, I think there's something, some sort of non-reproducible physical phenomenon that's we can see with multiple sensors, radar, eyeballs at the same time, that works in ways we don't understand. And I don't know whether that's some electromagnetic thing from deep in the earth, like, you know, some sort of, you know, sprite or whatever. I don't know. But I know there's something going on here. I think we've kind of crossed over to the, oh, we really need to look into this serious phase.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's like, you know, is it some foreign power having technology we don't know about, but then don't we have the best stuff? It's like somebody made some innovation, somebody discovered something. Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, yeah, this is kind of a lose-lose because whatever it is, if it's some sort of new physical phenomena we haven't been investigating, and that sucks. If it's a foreign power, that really sucks.
That really sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, a new phenomenon actually is interesting because then there's possibilities of finding something to use it
yes.
for.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so I think you must be an optimist, Daniel.
Absolutely. Well, you know, hey, welcome. John.
Howdy.
We're talking UFOs, and we're not talking Martian UFOs. We're just saying that Eric Weinstein, do you know Eric Weinstein?
I do not.
So Eric's a super smart math physicist guy. He's to the left of the spectrum. But he's been sort of calling the emperor wears no clothes for a while now as far as the public discourse goes. And he just admits that over the last year or so, he's finally kind of come to the realization that, you know, maybe something weird is going on. You know, maybe there is some physical phenomena. We could be some sort of electromagnetic thing. Who knows? And we just kind of, James and I were just saying, well, either way, you kind of lose. If we haven't been investigating for 30 years, we lost that time. If it's a foreign power, we lost the competitive ability. So that's the nerdy part of that. Have you been abducted by any aliens recently, John?
No, but I did see a UFO when I lived in the middle of Ohio. I remember being, and I saw it two nights in a row, and it was, you know, it's just walking out in the backyard, and up in the sky was, you know, from this perspective, like an inch long white line.
Oh, wow.
And I was used to watching things go across the sky, like the, you know, the different satellites that would blink, you know, and you, yeah, so I was used to that as a kid. But this line was extremely nonlinear. It would move in jerky motions and come back and then do stuff. And then, you know, so it wasn't like it was doing any kind of celestial type, you know, or atmospheric type motion. It was this bizarre white line. And I saw it again around the next night, and it would just dart with, you know, super speed.
I'm fascinated with it. I'm a pilot, so I'm used to sort of getting temporarily disoriented while you're flying, trying to figure out where you are, seeing Venus or whatever. So you kind of push through it, and you really don't talk about it that much. I almost landed at an Army helicopter base once by accident. And so, yeah, you make mistakes. But I think part of the problem here is that nobody really wanted to admit that they were seeing something kind of weird.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of landing at the wrong airports, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, I'm driving down the road near Palwaukee Airport, now known as Chicago Executive Airport. And here's a C-5.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
On its way to come in. And luckily the pilot said, oh, shoot, this is the wrong place, because he never would have gotten that plane up off the ground.
Oh, I thought you were talking about, because there was one where the pilot actually did land.
Oh my God.
And they had to, they couldn't take off again.
Yeah. So they were about to land the C-5 there. And I heard about it in the news. It's like, well, they averted and went to, you know, where they're supposed to go, O'Hare or whatever. But they would have had to take the plane apart.
Yeah. There was some bad story like that, where one of those big planes, like it was right next to the military one or something, you know, easy to mistake.
Yeah.
It's like, oh crap. Yeah.
There was a famous case, and I don't want to get started on aviation, but there was this famous case of a 737 coming from South America, and they lost both engines. I think it was a thunderstorm, and the pilot was actually a glider pilot, and so he put the whole plane right down on a levee, right in Louisiana, just landed the whole thing. Everybody got off. Nobody was hurt, but then now you've got the 737 on the levee. He's like...
Yeah, I'll just mention the glide slope of a... that's the same thing Solly did. Like, I think he was a glider pilot.
Yes.
Yeah. You really learn energy management when you're a glider pilot. Yeah, there's no go-arounds. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that one of the coolest things I did was my instrument training. I was under the hood at, I think, 7,000 feet, and the instructor pulled the engine, and I managed to do a shoot an instrument approach gliding. And nice. that was like, oh, my God, this physics thing actually kind of works. Shit.
So am I allowed to admit I landed on a golf course?
Were you somebody able to take back off afterwards, or?
I asked the pro after he went and got 5 gallons of gas that I put in the wing tanks. I asked the pro to, take me out to your longest fairway, and I took the tail end next to the trees.
Yes. Full brakes, full power,
brakes.
Full flaps.
Short field takeoff. God is my co-pilot.
Don't let anybody fly an airplane. Jeez.
I love flying more than I loved anything else I've done in life. Besides being a father, it was super cool.
Yeah. I never got past VFR.
I wanted to go all the way to instructor. I never got to multi-engine. I actually took a couple hours of amphib on San Francisco Bay, actually. But I just...
Wow.
Yeah, fun stuff.
Cool.
So the next one's neural actor. This is neural free view synthesis. Basically, this is a lot of words to say that whereas this fake video stuff is actually mapping people's faces onto a pre-existing video, what this is doing is using AI to create a skeletal model of the person. So this is sort of another part of the whole fake new world we're building, where you can like show the computer a picture of somebody and it'll like guess what a skeletal model is, and then you could map, I guess, the fakes. This is bizarrely weird. I don't know.
Well, it was weird seeing all those different people doing the exact same dance.
Yes.
And then Daniel, they're going to be able to put you at the scene of the crime one day with this kind of technology.
Yeah. We're reaching the point where you're not going to believe a damn thing you see. And then it's like, well, what's the point of the internet then if you don't believe anything?
Well, we're kind of getting there anyway, right?
Sometimes the videos are tough to know if they're real or not.
Yeah, and you can do digital signing to show that the device actually took the image, and maybe there's some sort of digital signing thing we can come up with. I don't know.
Well, you can fake digital, no?
Well, no, signing actually shows it hasn't been tampered with. So you take the bits and whatever the thing is, and you put it as part of the envelope. You put like a digit. It's like a hash, but it's a cryptographic hash.
Yeah, okay.
So the guy reads the cryptographic thing, decomputes the hash, then compares the hash to what the payload is to see if it's been tampered with. It's long and short of that.
Yeah.
Next up is the military's mobile nuclear reactor. So they're like building a little backpack, or, well, I imagine it's the size of a pickup truck. Or, yeah, there we go. It's huge. Big honker. But they finally reached the point where they realized, you know, power is a real issue. We should have been building, like, little nuclear reactors a long time ago.
Yeah, and this budget for this is only, like, what was it, $60 million? Like, what the heck? With all the money we're throwing around wasting, why not waste some on this?
Yeah, I've long said, you know, like, the day of worrying about it should have long ago passed. I mean, if you track the nuke aircraft carriers,
yes,
you know, even the footprint, you know, they used to have pretty big footprints for the the nuclear power plants. They've gotten a lot smaller. You know, when's the last time you heard of an accident? Like, why can't they be, like, I wonder, would they power, I don't know, 100,000 or 20,000 homes? Why couldn't you have those around instead of?
Yeah, so you got this one they're talking about here, 1 to 5 megawatts, and it's doing a little bit of looking to see what does it take, what does a megawatt get you? And it gets you like 900 homes.
Yeah. Right?
So, if you had 5 of those, you know, you got like 5,000 homes covered by one of those.
Yeah, imagine what you could do with that in terms of, you know, reducing transmission lines and being able to, I don't want to say, but I like people living in cities so that I can have more freedom outside of a city. I think cities are worthless.
You're onto something there, my friend.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll get infected by some disease.
Yeah, or just a ton of people that I don't want to be next to.
Tyranny of the minority is what happens. Yeah. This is, I guess, the theme so far. This is another thing that 30 years ago we should have been looking into, and it's just, but why is it taking so long, guys? It just.
Well, they must have been looking in for 30 years. I mean, for because only $60 million to finish it now. I mean, somebody's been paying for this under the radar, probably.
Hollywood movies that breed panic.
That may be part of it. Part of it may be the fact that they finally reached the point where they realized that the average foot soldier has this huge, like, sucking thing going on as far as energy they need, and there's no way of, in other words, delivering electrical power has become even more important than, like, petrol or ammunition or whatever.
Yeah, so that's really cool.
Cool stuff either way.
Yeah.
This next article, wonderful, wonderful takedown of science, the game of science versus, like, science, the actual thing. And this guy, if I remember, this is the neurologist, and he talks about, this is all about gain of function. Have you guys been reading any about the Wuhan lab and the gain of function research and all that?
Oh, yeah. I've been tracking that for a while. I mean, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation put, I don't know, $50 million or something like that into the Wuhan University there, and yeah, it's been going on for a while.
Yeah, the gain of function. Go ahead. I was just going to say the gain of function thing was this argument, as I understand it, and I'm not sure it's as crazy as it sounds, because when I say it, it sounds pretty damn crazy, that we should be making our own crossbred viruses now before they get bred in nature, and that way we can learn how to fight them.
That's the theory.
Yes.
That's the theory.
Yeah.
And this article is all about that theory going wrong, because grant money, if you can invent one more of these viruses, right? If you can make another crossover.
Yes.
Invent another engineered virus to study. Yes. Now you can get the grant money to study that.
Yeah.
My son's a PhD chemist at University of Florida. He's a researcher. So I sent him this article to see what he thinks about that. But I think, you know, after talking to him, he plays this game of, well, you got to publish. Otherwise, you don't have a job. He's about to get tenure, and so he's done enough. He's got grants and that sort of thing. But if you don't attract the money, you're not gonna be able to do research. And so, you know, it's got to be in something that somebody cares about.
Yeah, the guy talks in his essay about the crank. Like, the idea is to build a machine that you could just kind of keep cranking and making papers and getting research money. That's
that sounds like an abuse. And then they were saying the other thing, you should have a finite problem, right, where you either come up with a solution or you don't, rather than an infinite problem where you can just keep morphing it into a new grant stream.
Yes.
Right? You know, so.
Yeah, and certainly the ethical problem is, well, what happened? You know, there was the virus, pretty clear, the genome, like even though the Chinese released the genome sequence last year, they left off the critical part that actually shows it's made in a lab. I forget if it's the CGG or there's some string that makes it 100%, like one in a billion chance that it's not, that it was done in the lab. It was created and somehow through purposeful or accidental, it got out. So that's the dilemma, right? I mean, do you really need to create these things faster than nature? Like, why?
That's a good question. I saw this issue when it came out, and I was like, you know, I don't care. I mean, I care about this lab safety. I care about the gain of function. But as far as whether or not it was the Chinese who had poor lab safety or the Germans, or I mean, there's a lot of politics kind of laid on top of this story that I just didn't mean a lot to me.
There's one phrase here that was pretty interesting. Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine was developed in a few hours in January of 2020. It's like, so do we really need to make these mutants that might come and attack the whole world?
And it was developed in a few hours because they sequenced SARS
vaccine in a few hours from it. You know, it's like, why do we have to? Okay, so maybe we've done the research we needed to do already so that we can create a vaccine quickly. Yes. Somehow, better stop with all this messing with Mother Nature.
But I think that would be the argument, is that the reason it was done in a few hours is because they had desequenced the old SARS virus, and the more of those they actually put in the bank, the more they can pull out and fix. And I mean, ideally, you want virus solution. Tomorrow, you have vaccines.
Right. Back in the day, by the time they had that SARS virus vaccine ready, SARS disappeared, so they never needed it. The other thing that comes to mind is Yagni. Like, why are you working ahead on a feature that nobody needs?
You're not going to need it, hopefully.
And I continue to follow this sort of failure of institutions story. The press failed. The World Health Organization failed. I mean, just go down the list of institution after institution, and all of them had these narrow blinders on about looking after their own interests and messaging. And you put them all together, and you got crap coming out for people to consume. It was not so good.
And just think of the amount, the hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of lives lost because of it.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be able to have an honest conversation for 20, 30 years because of the magnitude of mistakes we've made here.
Yep. Not to mention the other interesting aspect, I don't know if it comes out, but when has the general lay public ever been exposed to any disease numbers, numerics, and graphs? Like, most people don't even know how many millions of people a year get the flu. So suddenly we inundate a public, like if you expose how many people died of car accidents every year or something like that, people would panic and probably not drive. I mean, stuff like that, that is also sort of a fascinating effect of
riding a bike in a city.
Yeah, do you ever know what normal should be for the like how many deaths we have per year? Did you ever look at that as a general? You know, of course, nobody ever looked at this stuff. And
have you seen Steve McConnell's graphing of the COVID data over the duration of the pandemic? It's kind of interesting. So he's he posted on LinkedIn. That's where I've been seeing it. And his latest thing, I just saw it this morning, is looks like COVID is gone now. Because he shows all his comparison graphs over the last several months, and it's just flatlined. And maybe in the U.S., where I'm not sure if it's a worldwide thing or a U.S. thing. But
yeah, well, that's why let's make sure we don't lose sight of the variant, because we got to keep this panic going, right?
You talk about the crank on the machine. I would every day bring up major news sites on the web, and it was just a cranking machine again, and it was just
that's right.
90 to 95% of the stories I saw, the headlines, I don't know what the text was, the headlines were just fear mongering, really, more than anything else.
Yeah, and then what's even worse, which the cynic in me says, they you know, the first time I heard about a study from Australia and France and somebody else about hydroxychloroquine having a positive effect on patients and 30 out of 30 recovered, I'm like, oh, thank goodness. I forget if that was April. Like, oh, there's a glimmer of hope in a really deep, dark, you know, like we're under lockdowns. So I thought, oh, there's a nice glimmer of hope. And then, of course, the wrong person mentioned it, and now hydroxychloroquine. And I've also said, cool, that's like $5 a pill. Yes. And it's been around since the 50s or 40s for malaria. It's super safe. And, you know, they give it to pregnant women sight unseen if you're going to a malaria country. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Yes, it's fascinating. It's the right, wrong people. And, you know, if grandpa, we've talked about this before, if grandpa's angry about something, whether it's me or some other dude that kind of looked like me, if he's angry about it, he must be wrong. It's just that's the law of the internet. It's one of the reasons I just don't talk about shit, because, like, I don't want you guys just telling me I'm wrong and hurting yourself. So just I won't give you my opinion. You can just figure things out on your. I was reading a Reddit forum that only allowed science publications to be posted, and I think I made one comment all year long, and I was interested in watching the scientists talk about COVID. And I was like 6 months ahead of the major news sources on what I knew and where things were going. And it's just like, holy fuck.
Yeah.
What the hell is the purpose of having all of these wonderful information distribution systems if people aren't informed anymore?
Yeah. Right.
Well, you know.
Yeah. Darn good.
It got politicized, so.
Yep.
That's it.
I'm angry about being angry.
Hundreds of thousands of lives lost because of hydroxychloroquine not being allowed for off-brand and being dissed by quote-unquote experts. And for FDA to go back and overrule what doctors could prescribe or not.
The HCQ story is one of those. Antivirals in general, folks, work before you get infected. So I saw studies where they were actually applying them to people who were in ICUs, and there had never been any evidence at all that you can apply an antiviral, because by the time you end up in the ICU, you're having a reaction to the virus. You're not actually being infected. But yeah, HCQ, it's beyond over my head, but I could follow. You know, things can be over your head, and you can still follow the discussion. It's fine. It's our system of justice is based on the fact you can bring 12 random people in and figure shit out, you know?
Yeah. Well, as I understand it, they're treating the symptoms. And so, hey, you know, why not treat the symptoms if somebody's going to die from those symptoms, right?
Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah, the like Stephen Smith was great. He's actually published a paper on his results, which are, you know, outstanding. And yeah, it was the cocktail of hydroxy plus Zithro and
zinc. Yeah.
And the idea is to keep it kept the virus from being able to attach. You know, like it had an effect of those little prongs being able to attach, something like that. But the point was, even the studies that they debunked, the quote-unquote debunked hydroxy, the studies were horribly done. They weren't done with the right doses that the medical practitioners were using, right? So they were completely worthless stories, studies.
Yeah.
All political.
Yeah, I actually saw studies that were being released that were just basically commentary, political commentary, sort of disguised as a scientific study that then they could publish as if it were science. And it was just...
Yeah, and how do you hold those people accountable for the fact that how many people probably died because you did not allow this to be practiced, you know, by the medical doctors?
I don't think you can hold them accountable. I think the best you can do is decentralize and have different systems and just say, hey, look, those guys look like they seem to be working okay, and these guys seem like they suck. And it's okay to say that in a general fashion, but to say our rulers suck, it's just, I don't think you're ever going to get anywhere like that.
Yeah, you're probably right.
So next is a Feynman quote, which I thought was awesome. If you don't make mistakes, you're doing it wrong. If you don't correct those mistakes, you're doing it really wrong. If you can't accept that you're mistaken, you're not doing science at all. And this is just what we're talking about.
Yep.
There's probably some sort of fourth sentence here about cross-disciplinary stuff and how anybody can contribute to science at first, but then they sort of narrow down the allowed number of people who can talk in any one field until it's just all an echo chamber. That's probably the part he was missing here, but it's good stuff.
Yeah, I have a little ritual to help my test-driven development people that are in my training class that we do. It's like, okay, so you care about fixing bugs, and I get everybody to say they do it, and say, okay, everybody stand up, repeat after me. I'm a programmer and I write bugs.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a great little exercise with a team yesterday around writing a story. You know, and I like to promote behavior development. You know, kind of a cucumber. You know, tell you know in the feature at least express a little bit about you know who's doing it, what do you want them to do, and why. Some of them, you know, what value and you know little. I always say you need to know the level above the feature, so put a little context there, and then the yes. given when thens and that kind of thing.
Yep.
And. So then one of the organizers, Matt, said, how long do you think we should be in a breakout room? I said, 10 minutes, just because, yeah, don't let us, you know, dwell too long. Yes. 10 minutes, yes. Let's come back out and see how far.
Yes.
And the room I was in, and I'm, you know, I could, probably could have done it in, you know, 2 seconds, so to speak. It was pretty easy to see for me. And that's because I've practiced a lot, right? And it was fascinating. We barely got one sentence done of what the feature is, who it was for, and what the value was. And it also expressed, because this is the stuff that's in their system that they think is, you know, this is about the definition of, you know, when are you ready to start development with this story? Is this story ready as written? Because, well, it should have been, because it was pulled from the stack of the real world. You thought it was. And it was pretty fascinating how hard it was. And that kind of failure teaches so much, so to speak. Yeah. You know, the ability to like, wow, this is really hard. And, you know, and that's from a developmental learning point of view, like a diplomat, you know, mindset or an expert mindset, you know, that sometimes that failure is really hard to take.
Yeah.
You know, if you're hell bent on, you know, being right. So it was a wonderful opportunity for everyone to go, wow. We have a long way to go here.
That's a great take, John. I want to, this is related to what we were just talking about. I think software developers get a bad rep because they say that we're willing to kind of wade in on any topic at all and sort of start making calls on it. And it's not really because we're cocky. I think it's kind of the opposite. It's true. It's like we're such a screwed up discipline, and we're expected to meet everybody else in all their other disciplines and figure out what the hell they're doing. That you combine those two, and it's like, you know, I don't know myself how to write two lines of code without a bug. How can you guys be so confident about this really complex thing you've put together? And yeah, it's coming from a place of humility, not necessarily cockiness.
Exactly. That's what I lead my talks with and end my talks with. You know, it's about being humble and being curious. Yeah, I mean, it's a hypothesis that someone even wants this feature. You know, like, treat things more like a hypothesis and be more humble, please. Can do maybe a little less than you think is necessary, because you might not be right.
I'll add to that. Look behind what somebody asked for what problem they're really trying to solve. Because oftentimes, you know, they've given, like we had a project on my brother's company, and the story that the user of this report came up with is run the report every night at midnight. And as I asked him, you know, why is that important? He goes, well, it takes like 2 hours to run the report. It's like, oh, well, so your problem is you can't get up-to-date data, so you want the report run every night at midnight, so you've got it sitting there waiting for you. Yeah. What if the report didn't take 2 hours to run? It's like, oh, that would be cool, too. You know, that would be great. Then,
yeah.
You know, so.
I've had customers tell me that I couldn't do something technically. I was like, hey, you can have instantaneous blah, blah, blah. And they're like, no, you can't do that. I'm like, no, I actually know. I think we can do this. We can make it. No, because we've had this thing for 20 years. We never could have that. That means we could never, ever have it. And it's like, okay, I'll do the technical stuff. You just kind of worry about what you kind of want the business to do here. But customers will actually, the scary thing is, first of all, most teams won't even talk about what the real problem is. But secondly, customers will wade in and start coding the system for teams. And a lot of teams will just kind of go hands off and let the customer wait around and do all sorts of crazy shit. And they're like, okay, that's fine. I'll write this down. That's good.
Yeah. And I know the video keeps being broken here, but yeah, that's so important. That's why I call it the level above, you know, or the you said behind or, you know, behind it. But yeah, it's context. It's really to understand and use it as an opportunity to negotiate scope.
Yes.
And, oh, I see. Right. And or even discover that.
Yeah.
Don't be an order taker. And John Turley and I were just talking right before this, you know, and he said, that's easy for you to say because you are able to take other people's perspectives. That's a higher level of development, you know, personal development. And, you know, so we're actually working on some pretty exciting stuff to try to help bring people further forward in their own developmental journey, because that's like perspective flexing. It's, you know, I can stand above and kind of see, but we need to help people learn that you need to ask, you know, what is the perspective of the client asking for this report?
Yep.
You know, and that's what you did, James. Yeah.
What problem are you trying to solve? As an engineer, I want to know what problem I'm trying to solve.
Software development's weird because it's the only place I know that you'll pay somebody six figures, sometimes mid upper six figures, to code on a system that transfers maybe millions of dollars a minute different places, and yet you're worried about where they're parking the parking lot, and there's just rates, and there's all this other crap as if they're like ready to rob the bank at any moment, and you have to be careful. It's like, what the hell? What do we... And I just come to the conclusion that we don't know how to manage software projects. I think this industry has no idea what they're doing.
Correct.
Well, you're managing invention. Everything is new. Yeah, there's knowns, of course, and there's unknowns, and so you have to manage this creative process, which, you know, there's a discovery that needs to be done to find out what to do. Like, what problem are we trying to solve, and how do we solve it? Those are...
Well, there's a lot of comfort to frameworks, too, like whether it's a management framework or a coding framework. If you're plugged into some big picture with flowcharts and all kinds of stuff, that's a comforting spot to be in. You've got things you're supposed to be doing, and it's much easier than winging it and trying to figure out just what the hell are you trying to solve here, bub? You know, tell me.
Yeah, exactly. That's the prescriptive process is super simple. I'm just going to stick in my little corner of this chart here. I'm this cog. This is my role. These are my inputs. These are my outputs. I don't have to think that hard. And and also no innovation will happen. But that's the way some companies treat it, like the software factory. That's not how I treat it. If you want truly innovative work, you have to support the development of the individuals and support their well-being and their autonomy, because you can ask all you want for people to be autonomous, but the way they hear it, they may not pick up on this suggestion.
It's an incentives thing as well. I mean, I've actually had friends of mine that were here on work visas, you know, tell me privately, it's like, you know, gee, we're here on a work visa. That means we finish in a week, we go home.
Right.
That's a powerful argument. Next up is nuclear clocks may outdo atomic clocks. Have you guys been following this atomic nuclear clock thing for any period of time?
No, because they sound the same.
Only for 1 hour now.
So atomic clocks work by electron shells and the quantum states changing, and that they atoms actually kind of vibrate like a crystal. These guys are looking at actually making the nucleus vibrate, if they can make that happen. But the cool part of this story actually isn't mentioned. They're as they move 10, 100 times more precise, they're going to end up with these general relativity detectors, because the time... You get so good on detecting what time it is, you'll be able to like determine how mass changes in space. I mean, like a mountain or a car moving by or whatever. So this could get some really weird places in another 30 or 40 years, like a tricorder, pretty much.
Oh, I like tricorders.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah.
Except for the first one's going to be like probably the size of a gymnasium.
Probably it'll have to be small.
But you're not going to carry a gymnasium around, not unless you've got like a big... and related to that, and this one I don't really know what to do with, is they captured a quantum leap in process in the middle of the two, and that they thought they could never do that. And this makes no sense to me. So I don't know. I have no idea what the hell's going on here.
I got to tell you, Daniel, the universe is analog again.
I'm hoping it's going to be like all written in like a JavaScript. Finally get the jQuery of reality going. I'm going to be great.
It's kind of interesting, you know, because I've been listening to this great book series or great lesson series on chemistry, because I want to know more about what my PhD chemist son knows about. And so they're talking about the electron shells, you know, and the discrete energy levels. And then this is saying, well, it's actually not discrete now. There is a transition between those two energy levels that you can actually watch, and you could actually rewind it, too. They were somehow rewinding it, or they were...
Yes, stop in the middle. But yet we were just talking about atomic clocks, and the reason they work is there is a fixed amount of energy that makes a definite flip between one state and the other. So,
well, from a certain perspective, over a certain time interval, that looks to be true. But now they're looking at something even, you know, more precisely, and they're discovering it's a continuum. So there you go. The universe is analog again.
So if you really want to go down the rabbit hole, look what Stephen Wolfram's doing with his latest version of New Kind of Science. He has this kind of Conway's Game of Life in three dimensions, creating sort of a brain, I guess, nodes connected to other nodes. And he feels like he's constructed a whole theory of reality off of that, and he's way, way past anything I understand. It's wild stuff.
Yeah.
All I know is he's really smart. If you don't believe him, just ask him. He'll tell you how smart he is. He's always, he's one of those guys, have I showed you my PhD lately? next one is, where do meteorites come from? This guy did a study, a study of meteorite sand all over the world, and they're able to like source where most meteorites come from, and it's somewhere in the asteroid belt. We've never seen a meteor before, so it's like there's a missing piece of either astronomy or geology or something here that they're trying to figure out.
Is this, so I only like skimmed this one a little bit. Is it because all the particles that they destroyed of meteorites, they have the same chemical composition?
Well, yeah, there's little crystals that they can analyze, and those little crystals will show which asteroid it came from. And the little crystals we're finding don't match up with the ones that we found recently. So there's some, on a regular basis, there's some source of meteorite dust that we don't know what it is. It just keeps pelting us.
Hmm. Because they're different than other ones?
Right.
That doesn't fit between my ears, but okay, I'll have to read this one again, I suppose.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I have a pickaxe, like a rock axe thingy that looks exactly like that. I want to almost run out and go get it from when I was a kid.
So yeah, these things are spinel grains. So that's the thing they're using to source extraterrestrial chrome spinal grains. That's how you figure out what meteorite came from.
Wow, that's crazy.
Looks like fun. I mean, you get the little hammer out, you get to kind of wander around the world looking for dust. How tough could that be, you know?
Well, if you can get somebody to fund that.
Yeah, it's much more serious than that. Speaking of things that were not serious at all, why zebras were never domesticated.
And yeah, I've always wondered about that.
Yeah, I include this just because I think it's awesome. Pictures of people riding zebras around. This is something I've always wanted in life. I've never had before.
Yeah, I think I heard because they really are not, you know, they're not that cooperative, is what I think.
Yeah, there's so much predator-prey relationship on the savannah that zebras could be domesticated, but they're just scared of them shit, basically, more than anything else.
Yeah, they can kill a lion with a back kick, you know, so. And then another thing in this article is that a reflexive action is that when they're in danger, they put their head down, which makes it hard for them to be lassoed.
Yes.
So you can't catch them.
Not to mention that's a good way to throw a rider.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you're interested in pictures of people riding zebras, and they have been domesticated in the past, it's just the breed as a whole is just way too skittish and mean to breed.
Yeah, well, you know, I had a donkey. Well, you don't know this. I had a donkey as a pet when I was a kid. And so you can put a saddle on a donkey and ride it. It just, it won't cooperate.
It goes where it wants to go, I guess.
You know, it will go where the food is. It might decide to scrape you off on a tree.
Yeah.
You know.
That's the classic. Yeah.
Aren't you supposed to put a stick with like a carrot hanging off the end in front? Is that the donkey that the...
Yeah. I think a donkey would probably catch on to there. Pretty smart, you know. But eventually catch on to that one.
Yeah, that's why they use mules.
Yeah, the difference between a donkey and a mule. You can breed donkeys, but you can't breed mules, I guess.
A donkey is a real species, and a mule is a cross between a horse and a donkey.
Okay.
And they can't reproduce.
Yes,
so. Yeah.
That's why they use them for like Grand Canyon. They're a good pack animal.
Ah. Yeah, so they're stronger than a horse and maybe more docile or something.
Yeah, I think so.
That's the donkeys for the pack animals, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, not to me. Okay.
Well, the mules, I think, are better. They're more well-natured.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess like a lot of dogs that are mutts are nicer than some purebreds. I don't know. I'm just making it up.
I know that you don't want like a bunch of donkeys trying to mate one another while you're on their backs in the Grand Canyon, because that would Completely ruined the trip for about everybody, really, except for the donkeys. Yeah,
a bunch of high-strung thoroughbreds, you know, that should be running Belmont Stakes or something.
Yeah. Our donkey used to escape. You know, she would escape and go to the other donkey in the neighborhood, which was about a mile away, and have to get through the forest to go to the male donkey's house. And when I was a kid, my parents they had them spend some time together. You know, we thought we might have some baby donkeys.
Hey, hey.
They never got the job done.
Hot donkeys in your area. It never works out. You swipe left, it's a bad life for donkeys. Yep. So next is somehow this robot sticks to ceilings by vibrating a flexible disc. This is some sort of dark magic that I don't know. This is just freaking weird. If you guys want to check out the video at some point, it's a disc that somehow they vibrate a fluid underneath the disc, and they're able to just move vertically on top of ceilings, wherever they want to go, because they create a sort of a dynamically changing suction, maybe?
It sounds like this device really sucks.
It really sucks. Yeah.
Well, I often wondered, you know, like how do geckos and how do spiders, how do those critters, how does it work?
I don't know. Yeah, because they can go up on the ceiling. It's, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know, but the really scary thing is that we're actually sort of productizing whatever they're doing. We're turning it into products, which means we're going to see things that we make kind of moving around like that, and I don't want to see that.
Did they say where the idea came from? Did the idea come from nature?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Bio-inspired, yeah.
Yeah, there you go, cool.
Next up is... a most nerdy article. This is the pedantic checklist for changing the data model in your web application. There's nothing rocket science-y here. This is kind of like the one we did last week. This is nothing super technical, but it's like good stuff. It's like, you know, you've got a data model. You want to change it. Here's the things you need to sort of consider and sort of the steps to go through. I know a lot of newbies or even mid-level people get hung up on this. He talks about the different steps, and you change your adapters, change your back end. It's if you've done this, it should look pretty familiar.
Do you end up leaving behind while you're going through the process, leaving the existing alone, and getting to a point where what's the saying? It's make the change easy. This might be hard, and then make the easy change.
If you do this correctly, you reach the point where the change is really, there is no change. It's just, you just sort of slowly morph over to a new system, and it's a non-event.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's easier to keep a system working than to fix it after you break it, kind of thinking.
Right. Yeah. There's no bang here. No big bang at all.
No. I've done that sort of approach a lot, where you just sort of morph into a new and better model as you learn something. And sometimes I've even gone so far as, I don't bother migrating. I'll do it on the fly. And because if nobody ever touches some old crap, that, you know, it depends a lot on the context and what do you have in your database, what needs to be changed. But yeah, you can, there's a lot of funny attitudes about things like migration and doing stuff like that. And, you know, or even going to a new version, writing something brand new for your customer. You know, there's somehow we always think, there only ever is one thing, and that one thing always has to be right.
Yeah.
Versus, yeah, you don't really have to migrate. Like someone migrating, 8 gigabytes of freaking history in the damn, you know, Git repo or some bullshit like that. Why? Why do you need all that old stuff? You don't need to, you know, or Jira issues. People have years and years of years, and they might want to migrate to something simpler. I'm like, why do you need to bring all that along?
Yes.
No one's going to look at all your old crap. Stop being a hoarder.
Yeah. We see people,
but it's that same kind of idea.
See people like 1,000 Jira tickets they have to do. Like, we can never catch up. It's like, okay, just do the top 10 and ditch the rest. We can't ditch the rest. I'm like, you're never going to ever do that. 999, you're never ever getting there. Just forget it.
Yeah, and I think I first did this when I was younger. Dating my wife, and I couldn't get my checkbook to balance, and I was just, I'm just going to open up another checking account. Don't care.
She's, I didn't think to do this with Quicken.
No, I'm just going to stop using it. It'll eventually come to some level. Right? But that's that kind of mentality. Like a lot of people, you know, you want to force it. There's only one. Nah, I'm just going to make another. I don't need to bring everything up to speed. Screw that. Sometimes you do, but you don't.
I think there's this huge desire I have as a coder to things must be in a certain order in a certain way, and you've got to be able to turn that off and on because you can't use it everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, John, I just did this with my Quicken this year because I hate doing anything like that, but I've always been meticulous about it until last year I didn't. I did other stuff, and now I went to get my bank to update Quicken, and it wouldn't. And it's like, oh, no. It's like, okay, I guess I'll just start over clean in 2021.
Ah, good. Well, yeah, I can't speak to this because I am a financial, idiot savant. Just, the idiot savant? I'm just the idiot part. The savant never, ever came back. Yeah, my wife handles the books because I can't be trusted with like 10 bucks in my pocket.
Yeah, that's what it turned out for my relationship. She didn't buy my idea of just creating a whole new account.
Well, when I met my wife, I was like, 2021. And my system of bill payment was I got the bill, I put it on the desk, and I ignored it. And then once something got turned off, I would dig it through the bill to call the guy to get it turned back on. It worked okay for a while.
Yeah, it's wait till the last possible responsible moment, yes. Or maybe a little later.
Well, then you'll be like me, 3 days late on paying my property taxes here in Illinois. So I got to go take care of that right after this. I just had a realization this morning. It's like, you didn't pay your property taxes. Oh, no, that date's come and gone.
Yeah, I just got something from what you see is what you get, text editor saying, we're a couple, May 24th overdue or something like that. Oh, I'm guessing something automatic must not have happened because, you're using our product and your web app. Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah, I rebooted my computer this morning and I had three or four things. Oh, by the way, you're using this. It'd be good if you sent me a donation. Oh, by the way, this will be all these little messages and I just wiped this machine 2 weeks ago and I've only got maybe a dozen programs and I'm already getting nagged about all these things that are expiring or needing me.
I do buy, like I use rubular.com every once in a while for regex. And every once in a while, when I find myself using it, because it's usually for a doozy problem, something pretty significant that I can't just do by hand. And I'll click on the thing and send them some money. I forget what it is, but there's a lot of people put some really cool free stuff out there, and I like to give them some love every now and then.
Yes, I agree that there are a lot of people that are in third world countries that 10, 20 bucks means a lot to them. Okay, so this last one is just MIT course is starting up, I think, this week or next week on Introduction to Philosophy. And the reason I brought it up was I'm kind of interested in taking one of these online courses. I haven't taken any yet. Have you guys tried one of these things? I know there's a bunch out there now.
I'm listening on Audible right now to this one on chemistry. So it's one of these great courses, which I think that's what these guys are claiming to be.
Well, no, they're not. No, that was actually part of my question, because I've done probably 50 to 100 great courses. I've done a ton of them. I just didn't know if there was these are like university actual kind of courses. I don't know what the difference is.
Nope, I haven't done one.
James, send me the link to the one you're doing with chemistry, because I would be interested in doing that.
Okay, sure. It's in Audible.
Cool.
So I guess I think it's appropriate for me to question why do we teach chemistry in 10th grade?
In 10th grade?
You think it shouldn't be taught at all or taught early? Or what? Why do you...
I don't know. It's just funny to think about why do we teach the things we teach?
It's kind of interesting that, teaching chemistry outside the context of figuring out chemistry is kind of like teaching physics without calculus was why? But when you see them together, I don't know, for me, it was kind of an important thing to see physics and calculus together, because it's like, oh, these are, somebody made some guesses about how the world worked, and then they discovered this math rather than this math just exists, popped out of somebody's head. No, they're trying to explain the world. And, so.
Yeah, once you start doing algebra 2 or calculus with physics, it's just like, it's just sort of, heavenly choir thing. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think my point about some things are, I think what you're getting at, James, is when there's an application, a lot of it clicks. Like partial differential equations were kind of like,
yeah.
Huh? But then when I used them to help solve multiple differential equations to, you know, have a aircraft model come to a stable point at, you know, whatever operating condition you wanted, it's a lot of little things that have to, they're, you know, they're, the partials have to come to small enough zero, so to speak, to say, all right, you're at steady state. But yeah, I think chemistry, it probably went into more detail than most of us actually need. I think the fundamental ideas are pretty cool, that, hey, yo, there's this whole stuff called molecules and atoms and smaller things than us. Yeah. And yeah, that's kind of cool. But I think, I don't know, a lot of the details are probably lost on most people. Well, that might be true of lots of things.
I still remember avocado's number, which is how many avocados you can put into a bucket with it.
That's can you have
four avocados? Yeah.
0.023 times 10 to the 23rd?
Yeah, it's you have to have a pet mole, I think. There's some number moles are involved in somewhere or another.
Well, a mole.
Oh yeah, but no voles. Only
no voles. Yes, so definitely no voles.
A mole is
I don't know why they diss moles, but yeah.
One mole of something of hydrogen weighs a gram.
That's at STP. Yeah,
and that's 6.023 times 10 to the minus 20 times 10 to the 23rd.
Chemistry just clicked for me, so I can't diss. I was math, chemistry, hard sciences, science. That was my kind of stuff.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Yeah, but it's still. No, I did use it for certainly the part where we had to compute weird stuff in the combustion. You know, whether it was the combustion chamber for a turbojet or for rockets. You know, that kind of, you know, what actual sorts of things are happening when you put these chemical ingredients into.
The weird thing about, you know, I think back on my chemistry class, and it's been one of those things, almost like learning about music or painting. It just keeps popping up here and there throughout my life. Like you talk about Niels Bohr and the history of the atom. These different little things were things I first heard about in chemistry class, and it didn't really connect at the time, but later on it's like, okay, this kind of fits into that, and these.
Yeah, I guess the theory is you're being exposed to some classical things like, you know, PV equals NRT, and yeah, but it's funny to think about. Yeah, how what's the average person remember?
Yeah, that would, an interesting question is, what is the most useless thing we teach people? The chemistry, that was, you know, could be one. I don't know. That's a good. I don't know.
Yeah, good question.
I took a class in science fiction, and I loved it because I love science fiction. But you know, kind of hard to get a job like watching sci-fi.
Well, if there's any era to do it, it would be this era where you could, like, maybe make a podcast following and, you know.
I'm really surprised. Looking back on my high school years, I am really surprised I became such a big proponent and defender of liberal arts education. And I never saw that coming. I hated the soft science. I hated English. I hated all that stuff. And as I've gotten older, it's like, holy shit, you know, there's the great books, the great writers. There's all this humanity stuff that doesn't, like, get you a job, but it just makes life a lot more enjoyable.
Yeah, well, that's the classic liberal education, which, you know, certainly has merit, right? I mean, because there is more to life than just the hard, you know, things that you might need in a job being an aerospace engineer or a computer scientist. Yes. It's a more broadening.
Well, yeah, part of it too
is luxury.
I think a big part of it is to understand that whatever question you're asking, whether or not it's how to live a good life or how do I figure out this math problem, whatever the question you're asking, other people have already been there, like really, really smart people. And if you have some kind of background, you can actually go find out what they thought about it and start from there instead of trying to reinvent it from wherever the hell. Because I read a lot of books that are just crap, and the reason they're crap is the author has no grounding in here's how far we've already came. They just kind of start, you know, blank slate and try to go forward from there, and that's not going to work so well.
That's a good point. You know, if you read about the founding of this great nation, what were the founders reading?
Yeah, they diss us by saying, you know, sometimes we worship the Constitution. The Constitution was a big hack, big compromise, a big hack, but it was a big compromise and hack by people who were educated in the classics, and what they were trying to do was prevent failure, as opposed to every other constitution where they try to, like, create a perfect world. They were actually just saying, just don't fuck it up. And they were trying to come up with different ways that it was going to fuck up and stop that from happening. And that's really kind of why it lasted as long as it did.
Right. Yeah. And in the course of humanity, it's a blip in time of this much freedom, you know, but it's still a blip in time because general rule of, you know, status is is oppression and rulers and dictators and kings. Yep. You know, even Europe, 100 years ago, dictators and kings and freaking nut jobs.
Happy times again on Nerd Roundup. But no, it's cool when you get an app right, whether that app is a political system or an app. It's cool. Like, hey, it works for a while. Hey, it's good.
Right.
So the last thing we have is James is going to give us this walkthrough of, what's it called here? Gathertown, right?
Yeah, Gathertown.
So all you have to do is watch. I think I can switch screens here. And James, you just start talking, and people will see what we're doing here.
Let me give John a link so he can go into Gathertown.
Oh, cool, yeah.
And Daniel, are you in there?
Yeah, I am. There I am.
All right, let's see. How do I chat this over to you, to both of you? Where's the...
upper right is the chat.
Can you see me? I see you, James.
Present now. Oh, there's a chat. Mine's in the lower right.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. So Gathertown, my son, PhD chemist, used this to run a conference and with a couple hundred people with poster sessions, you know, how the academics do it and that sort of thing. And he gave me a demo of it while we were having a happy hour one night, remote happy hour. And so so here's what Gathertown is. So I made the virtual Wingman Software Training Center here. And there's, let's see if I can get me work to start walking around. There's me walking there. I'm going to go up to the podium.
Okay. And I'll stand in front of the podium.
Okay. So there's a podium right there. And so if you were in my training class, you'd get a link to this and you'd be in there. And if I'm on the podium there talking, everybody in the room can see and hear me. And I can see, let's see, I don't have my camera turned on, so let's turn my camera on.
Yeah, I'm going through the startup here.
Yeah, okay. but so there's Daniel, Nerds. Your icon is like a...
I think it's Batman. A vampire, yeah, a Batman. Vampire.
Okay, I can see you're talking, but I can't hear you through that channel. But if you walked over onto the stage with me, Daniel's walk. There you go. Now we would be in communication because you're on the stage. We're in the same space.
Yep.
And anybody standing on the stage, everybody in the meeting could hear.
And you can see that I actually now can see his video on my screen. So you're looking at my screen, by the way, on the podcast.
Yeah. Okay. Now you can hear both of us talking.
I walk off the stage and I can still see your video, but you can't see my video, I guess, right?
Yeah, and so people that are in my training class might have to go off and do a programming exercise in one of these little rooms. So let's go into the room, Daniel.
Woohoo!
Okay, so now we're together in this room, and we instantly have a meeting with whoever else is in the room. There's John. John just joined us now, too. And some of your mics need to be shut off.
Yeah,
Gathertown mic. So now we're all in this room together. We can talk to each other. If we wanted to share a screen, you can share a screen. You know, so if we wanted to work on one exercise together in pair or mob, we could do that from this room. And then I'm going to be hanging around up on the podium. And if you have a question, you might wander over to the podium and ask me a question. And so if I hear. And so there I'd be waiting around, you know, surfing the web, doing something. Well, and then somebody comes over and asks me
a question. And I can actually walk up to John here, right? And if I walk up to John and hit the X button, is that...
That's nothing.
Oh, okay.
At any rate, right, so, you know, you're close to the podium, so I can hear you now. There's John. He's on the podium. Everybody can hear John.
Ah.
And if John said, oh, yeah, James, I want to ask you about how to deal with, you know, creating a new something and see what do we do. It's like, oh, if anybody else is stuck on that, let's all go over to the tiki bar over here on the right. And anybody that wants to hear the answer to that can come over there. You know, here's another private space. The tiki bar.
I feel like we're on South Park. It's fine.
So
what happened to Kenny?
Yeah, there you are. Okay, so
I think there's two Daniels. I think Danny need to mute one of your mics.
Okay, yeah, we'll do.
If you have your mic that's inside of Gathertown,
we'll do.
Yeah, because you're getting echoes. But
right, so better.
And when I use this for the first time in my training class last week, and when I went over to the side room, I thought, you know, nobody's going to come because just the one guy that wanted the answer. And all these little icons popped up from all the tables and ran over to the tiki bar to participate in the, you know, the demo or the question answering. And then people can go back to their places and that sort of thing. If you need a coffee break, just walk over here to one of these coffee machines.
All right. Well,
you can go hang out by the coffee machine and talk to people too. But that way I can go back and get people that are on copyright. Hey, come on.
Chop, chop, buddy. Chop, chop. Hey, time's wasted. I think this is cool. I like it. And you were saying you can actually edit the maps and create your own little universe here, right? Where'd you go? Nah. Okay. And so, huh? There you're back now. Okay.
Yeah.
You were saying that you can actually edit the maps and create your own little, all your stuff. You can have a room that you walk into and it starts playing a video or.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm in this, I made this map. And if we go back to the podium. I kind of set this up where all these little squares down here, they take me to
cool.
The room of the color.
So neat.
I can just walk into that room. I kind of teleported into that room.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So all kinds of cool stuff you can do. You could have different levels, and there's like a teleportation between different spaces. And, you know, for a conference, what's cool is if you meet in the hall, come on into the hall, guys. Come out in the hall. You meet in the hall. Hey, John, where have you been? It's been a long time since I've seen you. Kind of like a real conference. And
cool.
I like it a lot. I was telling James that I'm kind of done with Google Meet because we have all these dropping problems. We haven't had any problems at all with this so far. I'm thinking maybe trying this next week.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I would have, I wouldn't have like 10 rooms. I'd just probably have just one or two rooms, but it'd be worth kind of kicking around. And if it works, then maybe we could have more than, you know, 4 or 5 people, and that would work okay.
See if you can put one of the stories in one of the rooms or something. Ooh. Or a video in one of the rooms.
Oh, I like that. Oh, I like that a lot. And didn't you tell me, James, didn't you tell me your son had a conference with like 150 people using this thing?
Yeah, he had 150 people, and they were like, I'm going to make a guess now, like 20 poster sessions. You know, where the PhD chemist is standing by their poster and people can wander by and then they give them a little presentation. And, you know, then they had a bar in their conference area that people could go and hang out. And, you know, there were some other, like, keynote activities, you know, where you'd all go to watch a keynote address and that sort of thing.
So I don't want to sound like, I don't want to sound crass, but this is fairly new. And because it's fairly new, I'm more tempted to try it because Google Meet's old. And quite frankly, I don't really care. I don't think they care that much about us dropping connections. But these guys are probably looking much more carefully at the metrics of what's going on. I mean,
there's so many people are part of this company.
About 100.
If you go to the GatherTown website, it says that there's 23 employees.
That's great.
And they've created this awesome thing, which is just can't imagine.
It's pretty funny.
I wonder what the stack is. I'd be interested to figure that out.
Yeah, don't know. No idea.
So,
yeah.
Guys, stay right here. I'll be right back when we wrap this thing up for today.
Okay.
Right. And you have wasted yet another hour on Nerd Roundup, DanielBMarkham.com. Thanks for coming by. We covered a bunch of cool stuff. This GatherTown looks cool enough. I want to try this again. Appreciate your time. I will see you on the internet.